Hi everyone. It's really great to be here at the ABE's annual forecasting conference. For full disclosure, I am an ABE committee member, so thanks to my colleagues on the committee for landing me a speaking gig. Now, productivity. People over recent years have been talking about it a lot. Well, I mean, economists have been talking about it a lot, and arguably we are a subset of people. So, what has been driving that discussion over recent years? I think in some economies, this discussion has been about subdued growth in overall productivity, including in Australia since just before the pandemic. Now, there's also been discussion about the outlook for productivity, for example, the extent to which things like artificial intelligence, quantum computing, other technologies will support future productivity growth. Now, these are important questions that have already come up in the discussion today. But in my remarks today, I'm going to focus on a different question, which is, why does productivity matter? Now, Danielle addressed that a little bit in her remarks. I could see why she wanted to go first now. She's trying to steal my thunder. But I'm going to focus on that a little bit more, and I guess from the perspective of the central bank. Now, at the central bank, we are not experts in how to improve productivity, but trends in productivity are very important for the macroeconomy. So in the context of the Australian economy, I'm going to discuss how stronger productivity growth can support growth in aggregate supply, incomes, and aggregate demand. I'll then spend some time discussing recent productivity outcomes in Australia and how we've been thinking about those in our assessment of economic conditions. But first, what is productivity? So when we talk about productivity, we're talking about how much output we get relative to what we put in. So at an individual level, I increase my own productivity by making a shopping list before I go to the supermarket to make sure I don't forget anything and avoid multiple trips to the supermarket. At the firm level, productivity might be improved by implementing sort of customer relationship management software to streamline communications with clients to automate routine tasks, things like that. But at the economy-wide level, that's what matters for the central bank and our dual mandate of full employment and low and stable inflation. So at the aggregate level, productivity reflects a multitude of those individual decisions by firms and households. But ultimately, it's about how efficiently capital and labour are employed across the economy to produce goods and services. So how do we measure it? Economists typically focus on two measures: labour productivity, which measures how much output is produced for every hour worked, and multi-factor productivity, which I'll sometimes call MFP today. And that reflects how efficiently all inputs to production, so I think capital, labour, resources, like energy and raw materials, how they're all combined to produce output. Now, if I go to a simple production function framework, which Danielle alluded to, so where a firm produces outputs using two inputs, capital and labour, I can write this down in a way that labour productivity depends on two things. The first is how much capital each worker has to work with. So providing workers with more or better capital, like machines or faster computers, that can increase the amount of output that each worker produces. But the second way we can increase labour productivity is by increasing multi-factor productivity. So improving multi-factor productivity involves finding new ways to combine labour and capital to produce more output. So for example, reorganising a production line, using GPS technology, for example, in the agricultural sector to guide machinery for planting and fertilising and harvesting. So I think it's an important point to note there. So in this respect, labour productivity is not just about labour. So it depends on firms' decisions about how much capital to employ and also how efficiently that labour and capital work together to produce output. So in thinking about the relationship between productivity and aggregate supply, incomes and demand, I'm going to focus mainly on labour productivity. That's because labour productivity most closely aligns with measures of economic living standards, and it's also easier to measure than MFP. So as you might sense now, productivity is not about working harder, it's about working smarter. So many of the biggest productivity improvements have come from things that have made our lives easier. You think of computers, robots, the internet, smartphones. Actually, I need that to see how long I'm talking for. There you go. Personally, I'm still questioning whether smartphones are actually productivity enhancing or a productivity sapping distraction. So we talk about productivity a lot, so let's turn to the question now of why productivity matters. On the supply side of the economy, if productivity increases, the economy can produce more goods and services from all the available economic inputs. So as such, productivity is a key driver of growth in the supply capacity of the economy, or as us economist nerds call it, potential output. So productivity in Australia has been volatile in recent years, but looking through that volatility, it's around the same level as in the few years prior to the pandemic. So productivity has been consistently below our projections, the RBA's projections, for some time now. So it looked all right in those years leading up into the pandemic, but since then, not so good. So this has generated a lot of internal discussions inside the RBA, in fact, about what trend productivity growth might look like in the period ahead and what that might mean for example, estimates of potential output growth over the forecast period. Now, our current assumption is that annual labour productivity growth will pick up to around 1% in the medium term, which is close to its longer run average. Now, that could be consistent with, for example, the more rapid adoption of technology across many industries leading to higher productivity outcomes. However, that projected pickup in productivity growth, as you can see, has not materialised in recent years, and our staff are currently assessing whether these weak productivity outcomes are likely to persist. So weak productivity growth in recent years has contributed to slower growth in supply capacity or potential output. Graph 2 here, is a little counterfactual example. It shows one of our estimates of potential output based on actual productivity outcomes observed in the data. That's the orangey coloured line there. Now, the graph also shows a counterfactual path where productivity growth in recent years was higher at its average rate of growth in the two decades prior to the pandemic. So you can see from here, this suggests that the size of the economy is a lot smaller than it would have been had productivity growth been more like in the past. But it's important to keep in mind with this counterfactual, this world where supply capacity was much higher, that incomes and demand would also have been higher too. Let me turn to that now. So while productivity growth contributes to growth in the supply capacity of the economy, it also contributes to growth in incomes and demand. So at times, if I look at this chart now, you can see that labour productivity, or output per hour worked, and real income per hour track one another quite closely. That's the two lines in the top panel there. So looking through the volatility, both of these series are currently around similar levels as in the period prior to the pandemic. Now, it is worth noting that other factors besides productivity can affect growth in incomes per hour. For example, higher prices of Australian exports can generate higher incomes domestically. So the terms of trade, the prices that we receive for our exports relative to the prices we pay for our imports, they can also be an important driver of incomes in the domestic economy. And you can see that here in the decade from the early 2000s. So despite that slowing in productivity growth, you can see that productivity line flatlining over that period, real incomes per hour continue to increase, partly owing to the substantial increases in prices received for Australian exports. So for those of you who are looking at this stuff then, that's thinking things like iron ore and coal, where the surge in demand for our exports, particularly from China, supported profits in the mining industry and related parts of the Australian economy, but also supported demand for labour and wages growth. Now, over the longer run, labour productivity and real wages, and if I go to this graph now, so and here it's just important that real wages as measured by average earnings from the national accounts, so over the longer run, labour productivity and real wages tend to move together as well. Over the inflation targeting period, in fact, labour productivity has grown at an average annual rate of 1.1%, and real labour earnings have grown at 0.9%. So higher productivity doesn't only benefit firms, it also benefits workers by increasing their purchasing power. So actually, the Productivity Commission has previously pointed to the productivity of bakers as a reason we can consume more bread or even spend that money elsewhere. So apparently in 1901, it took 18 minutes of the average worker's time to afford a loaf of bread. Today, it's just 4 minutes. So there's got to be a joke in there somewhere about how we spend our dough. In the short run, however, growth in real wages and labour productivity can and do diverge. Now, this is important. And that can be, you know, as the economy, for example, is adjusting to economic shocks. For example, and as noted previously, increases in the prices received for exports can have an impact on domestic profits and wages without necessarily an increase in labour productivity. But ultimately, however, I think a key point is it's very hard for an economy to support real wages growth in the long run without productivity growth. Let's think about this in terms of consumption. So productivity growth also tends to support consumption growth. So when productivity and incomes are growing more quickly, people are able to spend more and consumption grows faster. Now, weak growth in consumption per capita over recent years, as you can see here in the far right of this chart, that's the blue line. So real consumption per capita actually declined in recent years. You can see that that has coincided with weak growth in productivity, real incomes and wages. You can see the weak productivity outcomes shown there as well. Now, it's interesting that similar patterns have been evident in other economies where subdued productivity growth has been associated with slower growth in household incomes and consumption. Now, obviously, the exception here, if you look, is the United States, where growth in both productivity and consumption has been relatively strong, as Danielle also alluded to earlier. So far, I've focused on the importance of productivity growth here for aggregate supply, incomes, and demand over the longer run. But now I'm actually going to turn to recent trends in productivity growth in Australia and some potential implications for the near-term economic outlook. Now, discerning trends in productivity over recent years is difficult because of volatility in the data associated with the pandemic and other supply disruptions. Looking through that volatility, you can see here that this is sort of the level of labour productivity over the ABS's productivity cycles and then multi-factor productivity in the bottom panel. So looking at that most recent period, labour productivity growth has been weak, averaging 0.2% per year between 2017-18 and 2023-24. Now, reverting to that simple production function framework that I alluded to earlier, the slow growth in labour productivity over recent years has reflected slow growth in both multi-factor productivity and the amount of capital available to each worker. So MFP growth, as you can see on the bottom chart here, it also averaged 0.2% per year over that recent period, which is well below its historical average. Now, some have argued that slower MFP growth could reflect temporary factors. For example, tight labour market conditions over recent years have been associated with large numbers of individuals entering the workforce. Now, in that sense, that bit of big inflows may have weighed on productivity. For example, if you think as workers coming into the workforce need to be trained, or if they move jobs and need to be retrained. And also potentially with large flows of employment with firms adapting their production processes to accommodate strong employment growth. Now, if this was the case, and you know, these are sort of temporary effects associated with the cycles in the labour market, you know, we could expect maybe that MFP growth might pick up as the economy adjusts. Now, there might be a little bit in that explanation, but work by some of my RBA colleagues finds that temporary factors like these have not been the primary cause of slow MFP growth, suggesting that structural factors could be weighing. So that's the MFP story. What about capital? So slow growth in the amount of capital available for each worker in the Australian economy. So slow growth in that is like saying a lack of capital deepening in the lingo. That's also contributed to slow growth in labour productivity. So capital per hour work was broadly unchanged for around 5 years, as you can see on the graph leading up to the pandemic. And then looking through the volatility in the data over the pandemic years, it's currently a bit below those pre-pandemic levels. So in other words, overall investment has not kept up with strong growth in employment recently. So to sort of give us a bit more sense of what's been going on in the economy, let's look at productivity outcomes in various parts of the economy. Now, I'm going to start with the non-market sector. So that includes healthcare, education, and public administration industries. Now, employment growth in the non-market sector has been very strong over recent years. Now, the level of measured productivity in some parts of the non-market sector is low relative to the aggregate economy. So as the non-market share of employment has become larger, That's weighed on overall productivity growth in the economy. Now, our estimates suggest that the rising share of non-market employment lowered the economy-wide measure of labour productivity growth by around 0.3 percentage points per year over that period from 2017-18 to 2023-24. If I look at that here, this graph shows the contributions of labour productivity growth over time, and that sort of reallocation, so that growing share of employment in the non-market sector and its contribution to overall productivity growth, that's reflected there in the yellowy coloured bars here. So that 0.3 percentage points per year in that most recent period, that compares with around a drag on overall productivity growth of about 0.15 percentage points per year over the previous decade. So the recent effects have been a bit larger than in the past. But there's more to this story about productivity and the non-market sector. So I emphasised before measured productivity in the non-market sector because it's very difficult to measure output and therefore productivity in parts of the non-market sector. Now, if you talk to the ABS about this, who do a great job thinking through these issues, the central problem here, the measurement problem, is a lack of meaningful prices for some non-market output. So think, for example, public hospital services being provided to public patients. So this makes it very difficult, if you can't identify the price clearly, it makes it very difficult to accurately identify quantities of output which are needed to measure productivity. And, and research by the Productivity Commission suggests that productivity in the healthcare industry is actually higher than official estimates. So as such, the drag on productivity from the non-market sector that we see here, that may actually be overstated. So noting the challenges of measuring productivity in the non-market sector, what's been going on in the rest of the economy? So labour productivity in the market sector, I'll bring up a table here just to do something crazy. If you look at that here, that in the market sector, over recent years, labour productivity growth has been 0.6%. That's been its average annual growth rate. If you compare that to its average over the preceding sort of couple of decades, 1.6%, now 0.6. So you can see that that growth has been a lot slower than relative to that previous two decades. So what's been going on a bit in some of that, in terms of some of the components of market sector? Well, if you think about mining, and some people do say, well, hang on, what about if you take mining out? So it's true, in mining, the level of productivity in mining is very high. So output per hour worked in mining is very high. That's the level. But over recent years, it has declined. So it's still very high, but it's been declining. So labor productivity growth in that industry in the mining industry has been very weak. So if you take that out, productivity growth in the market sector since 2017-18 has averaged around 1% per year. So it seems better, but that's still lower than the average over the preceding two decades and definitely well below rates recorded during the high productivity growth period in the 1990s. So more generally, there's been a range of explanations provided for slowing in productivity growth in the 1990s, and Danielle touched on a few. A list here, we have a well-documented for one in Australia is the declining economic dynamism, which basically says that it now takes longer for inputs to production to move to higher productivity firms, and it also now takes longer for firms to catch up to the global frontier of performance and technology. So evidence suggests that at least part of that decline in economic dynamism relates to declining competition in the economy, to Matthew's question before. Regulatory barriers also appear to have played a role in Australia, notably in the construction industry. So other explanations that get thrown around, slowing human capital accumulation, declining trade integration and mismeasurement. Don't ask me which ones are the most important because I'm not going to answer that. What does the recent subdued growth in productivity mean for our assessment of economic conditions? Well, while productivity growth is associated with growth in incomes and wages over the long run, in the short run, there can be material divergences. So over the past year or so, for example, real average hourly earnings in the economy, so that broader measure of real wages, they have grown faster than labour productivity. This exerts upward pressure on firms' unit labour costs, and that's consistent with our assessment that labour market conditions are still tight, notwithstanding some easing in those conditions over the past couple of years. So what's going to happen from here? Our latest forecast in the Statement on Monetary Policy incorporate a pickup in productivity growth over the next couple of years, which would add to the economy's supply capacity and help alleviate cost pressures. But there is considerable uncertainty around this projection. As you see, we've been wrong on it before. So if productivity growth remains weak, the near-term outlook will depend critically. So we're projecting a pickup, but if productivity growth remains weak, the near-term outlook for the economy, I think, will depend critically on how the economy adjusts to the continuation of low productivity growth. So if growth in demand is also weaker and wages adjust quickly to the slower growth in supply capacity, there might not actually be a material impact on overall cost pressures. But if demand in the economy picks up, as you know, as we expect and embodied in our S&P forecasts, or if wages adjust slowly, for example, to continued weak productivity outcomes, then cost pressures could actually be higher than we expect. So this adjustment process is going to be critical to what we see over the coming years, and we'll continue to monitor these developments carefully alongside the full range of indicators that that we look at. So to conclude, productivity matters because it's a key driver of economic living standards. Over the longer run, higher productivity growth expands the supply capacity of the economy and supports growth in income, wages, and demand. But in the short run, there can be meaningful divergences in the growth rates of these very important macroeconomic variables. Recent weak growth in productivity has constrained growth in aggregate supply, and whether productivity growth improves from here and how the economy adjusts are important questions for the economic outlook. Okay. Thanks for your time. I look forward to some questions.
Thank you, Michael. Tavis Strickland from NAB. Really interesting topic. I was just wondering whether your analysis on productivity growth has also been incorporated into the model estimates of the neutral rate, whether there's been a downward drift in the neutral rate because of very subdued labour productivity outcomes and how you're thinking about that at the moment.
Yeah, really good point, Tavis. So in estimating the neutral cash rate, an important determinant of that is, you know, is productivity growth. And so the way you would think about that is higher productivity growth tends to be associated with higher returns to capital, and therefore would lead to a higher neutral rate over time. So our estimates of that we use to come up with for the real interest rate, some of them do take into account these sorts of effects, but we try and use different approaches to make it more robust. But I think, you know, of all the unobserved things that we try and estimate, if you think of the neutral rate or the Nehru, things like that, I think it's really the neutral rate is the one where it really is very, very imprecise. You know, if I talk to my friends economic research and some parts of my own department, economic analysis, and, they're doing what they can to try and pin this thing down, but it's very, very sensitive, the estimates of the neutral cash rate, to the point where it could be anything, from 1 to 4 or something. So when you're sort of getting closer or thinking about what to do with policy, that's not particularly useful. But conceptually, yes, we do try and think about that.
Okay,
Rory.
Roy Robertson, Westpac Group Treasury. Michael, in the longer run, the sort of the gap between wages growth and productivity growth, feeds into price growth, inflation forecast. So one of the features last week of the Reserve Bank's inflation forecast in the Statement of Monetary Policy and the forecast in general was that somehow the Reserve Bank now doesn't get back to the midpoint of the band. So in November, 2.5 years out, you had 2.5% as the inflation forecast, and that was associated with 3.1% wage growth. So 3.1% wage growth was enough to be at 2.5%. But last week, 2.5 years out, we only get to 2.7%. So 3.1% wage growth gives you 2.7, not 2.5. So is there a sort of a new assumption that productivity growth is slowing 2.5 years out? Like, why does the Reserve Bank now have a gap of 0.6 I think that's right. Point four between 3.1% wages growth and 2.7% prices growth, 2.5 years out. Whereas in November, you had a much happier story where we're at the midpoint of the band because 3.1 wages growth got you 2.5%. So the 0.6 gap, of which essentially is productivity, became a 0.4% gap productivity. So productivity, what's that, falling by one third when it matters for all the monetary policy discussion. So just if you could talk about that issue, please.
Yeah. It's a good point, Rory. On that, I'll say a couple of things. So one thing, we have our productivity assumption, our projection we use. So that was downgraded a bit, in the near term in this round. But in your references there to wages growth, you're talking about sort of your WPI, wage price index type growth. Now, in assessing overall pressures, like labour costs faced by firms, the measures I think that really matters for firms is that broader measure of unit labour costs. So that takes into account this is the average earnings measure from the national accounts, that broader measure of wages. So that includes things like bonuses, overtime, but importantly, it also picks up compositional change in the economy. So people moving, for example, from high productivity to low productivity industries, the WPI won't pick up much of that, or as much of that. That'll get all picked up in the average earnings measures. So in terms of thinking about, so over the long run, you can look at the data. So unit labour costs, which takes that, average earnings per hour and adjusts it for productivity, right? So those broader measures of unit labour costs. If you look over the history of the inflation targeting period, so where inflation has averaged, a touch over 2.5, growth in unit labour costs has also averaged a touch over 2.5, right? So there is actually quite a strong long-run relationship between the broader measure of unit labour costs, and that's the one that we use in our inflation models, and conceptually I think that's the right measure to use. So they actually do move together over time. So given the weak productivity outcomes and the broader movements in wages from that broader measure of average earnings, that inconsistency that you pointed out is not apparent when you look at the broader measures. But there's a good point that you raise here. So the point here is that wages growth, as measured by the WPI, so that's a really good cyclical measure of wages. Like it gives you a good sense of where things are moving in the cycle, but it doesn't capture quite a lot of things, right? So we do, we don't hide what our views are on these other variables, and we talk about it, quite generally. When we start talking about inflation, we do talk about the broader measures of labour costs as well. But it's tricky as well, so particularly in the short run. To your point, the wages, the WPI measure is sort of a smoother measure. When you get to these broader measures of average earnings and unit labour costs, they can be volatile, and they are volatile, and then they can be revised as well. So that makes sort of getting a read in the near term, that makes that tricky. So it could be, that the WPI is actually giving a more accurate pulse, right, in that sort of recent disinflation, and that there's some other issues in the broader measures of labour costs. Absolutely could be true. So I'd characterise a little bit different, Rory. So in the sense that, so you're right on the wages, the WPI data is pointing to some moderation in looking at wages growth. Yeah, that's right, over the second half. If I go back a second, some of that unexpected stuff, in fact, most of that unexpected stuff for us has been around public sector wages growth, where we know that there are some big agreements sort of in the pipeline and the timing of those will matter. And so we could see quite a bit of volatility in public sector wages growth. But yes, there has been overall, wages growth did overall moderate by the WPI by more than we had anticipated. And some revisions to that data did show that sort of continued moderation, whereas the previous vintage of data had showed it a flat line. To me, that actually, in terms of the lags with these things, the most recent data actually line up a bit better with, I think, how we think about wages growth, to the extent that the unemployment rate basically was, or it had been, you know, unemployment had been going up a little bit, labour market conditions had been easing till sort of mid last year, right? With, given the lags, you might still see some of that earlier easing have fed through to wages growth, okay? So I think that's actually broadly consistent. The big question now is, given that the unemployment rate has basically flatlined over the second half of last year and into early this year, and some other measures are even tightened, if you look at underemployment, what's that going to do now for the forthcoming wages print? So could be that we get the further disinflation, as you're inferring there, but maybe that sort of, you know, the stalling in labour market easing might hold wages growth up. So one to watch.
That's all right.
Okay.
Next time.
Just
it was a really good question about wool. Knowing I'm talking to Crookwell's finest, two seconds. The role of commodity prices in productivity, Mick.
Yeah, so I think, Pod's from Goulburn, I'm from Crookwell, so we can talk about sheep till the cows come home. but I think the role of commodity prices, but I think it goes back to that that sort of terms of trade type effects. And, you know, some people have sort of suggested that, so I said there's, both productivity and real income and terms of trade movements can affect real income growth. Some people have sort of said, well, maybe that the, you know, movements in the terms of trade when it was high was associated with lower productivity growth. I mean, there's a correlation there, but some, work done by others, including some of my colleagues, if you look through that period, through the mid-2010s, mid-2000s to the 2010s, even if you take things like, you take the mining sector out, or take WA and Queensland out, you still see in the data this sort of more deeper slowing in productivity growth. So there could be something there, but we think there are bigger issues at play. And just before I finish, I want to thank my colleague Angelina Bruno, who's with us today, Kevin Lane and Jonathan Hamber, who each know a huge amount about productivity and helped a lot with preparing this. So thank you, everyone.